Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Well, today we're bringing you an extended interview with the former President of Ireland, Mary McAleese. And over the next hour, we'll explore her life and career through archive recordings, music and tales from her recently published memoir, Here's the Story. On the 31st of October 1997, the presidential election count took place at Dublin Castle. And by early evening, it was clear that Mary McAleese would succeed Mary Robinson as Uachtaráin na hÉireann. Here's how events were reported that night by RT News.
Even though the opinion polls had her well ahead in the race for Áras an Uachtaráin, Mary McAleese said she wouldn't believe it until the final declaration. But tonight in the Castle Yard, hours before that will happen, she was giving in to the inevitable, and this was her message.
I want to say thank you to them most sincerely, a very, very, very deep heartfelt thank you. I'm not quite elected yet, as you know, Gerry, but I'm looking forward to being later on this evening. And I, from the bottom of my heart, a heartfelt thanks to them and also a promise to them. A most sincere and I barely find the words for it, but a really warm promise to them to be the very best president I possibly can be.
Mary McAleese, it was a bruising campaign. How do you intend to heal all of those bruises?
Well, the ones that are the ones that were personal to me, Charlie, are long since healed, and all I can say is I think the teacher's absolutely right. The campaign is now behind us, well behind us, and I think it's important to forget the words that were said in the heat of a campaign and the things that were said. Put them well behind us now. Draw a line in the sand and look forward to very happy days ahead.
Then, just after 20 past 8, the National Returning Officer declared the first count result. It was watched by four of the candidates and Mary McAleese's family and friends.
Mary McAleese, Cúig Céad Seachtar Carraméala, Cair Céad agus Féach Cathair, 574,424.
And the applause told it all. Mary McAleese is on her way to Áras an Uachtaráin. In just under 2 weeks' time, she will be installed as the 8th President of Ireland.
Mary McAleese, good morning.
How are you, Miriam? Good to talk to you.
Me too. I really enjoyed your book. It's very, very interesting. I was just thinking, though, as we speak now, I think you're sitting in your home in Coote Hall in County Roscommon. And of course, you were born up north, lived in Dublin a lot, up there now. Where does your heart think is home, Mary?
Oh, where I am right now, without a shadow of a doubt. I look out my window and I'm looking straight across at the back window of my father's home, where his people have lived for centuries, never moved from there, centuries. Not far away is a little abbey dedicated to St. Aidan a millennium ago, that was founded by the Lenehan family, whom I like to think were his family, because he, of course, was Lenehan. So I feel very at home here. I absolutely love, you know, the Roscommon area. We're very close to Carrick and Shannon here. It's our nearest town, and it has to be the most beautiful town on the Shannon, one of the most beautiful towns in Ireland. Great community, very pretty, of course, very pretty and very beautiful. So look, this is home for me. I also, of course, have a great grasp for the north, for the Mourns, and in particular for the village of Roscommon, where my family moved to after a lot of upheaval in Belfast, a lot of bad times and cruel times. They moved to Roscommon, which also is one of the most beautiful villages in Ireland, right on the shores of Carlingford Loch in the foothills of the Mourne Mountains, and a place of great peace for us as a family after, you know, a lot of really rough seas, can I put it that way.
Yeah, and before we talk about that, Mary, tell me about your mum and dad. Neither of them from Belfast. How did they both end up in Ardoyne?
Yeah, well, my mum's family are from the Mourns originally, though she's one of 11 kids, and her mother and father were both from small farms in the Dromara Hills just north of the Mourns. But her father had been involved in the old IRA, and for that reason, going back to live there when they were married and having their family was difficult because there was a lot of sectarian stuff going on. He also found it very hard to get employment, and he'd been back and forth to Scotland working. But he got a job with Barney Hughes's bakery in Mahara. So my mother actually was born in Derry in Mahara. Then they came back to Belfast in the 30s, terrible blinking time. there were very few houses going, and unfortunately one of the areas where you could get a house, because nobody really wanted to live there, it was such a dreadful sectarian mess at the time, was where they went to live in Ardoyne. Meanwhile, my father, at the age of 14, born and reared in County Roscommon, got his first pair of shoes at the age of 14 and was put on the train for Belfast because his mother's three sisters had moved there for work. And they were all then living in Ardoyne. And they were quite entrepreneurial. You know, one had a little grocery, one had an off license, one had a hairdressing. And my mother, at age 15, went into that hairdresser's as an apprentice. And my father had come to Belfast to be an apprentice barman. And he ran across her as his aunt's apprentice. That's how they met. She was 20 when they got married. He was 26 when they got married. And they continued then to live in Ardoyne. That's where we were all born. We were all born and reared in Ardoyne, nine of us, until, you know, we were machine gunned out of our home there.
Now, you were their firstborn child, I think, Mary.
I'm number one. That's right. I'm the biggest. Yes.
But at birth, and I think this is really interesting when you write this in your book, you say you weren't just assigned a family name, but almost also a tribe.
Correct. Because, you know, I'm Mary. And I don't know if you called Mary, you know, among our clan, you know, you'd be knocked down in the rush because there's so many of them. And I was called after, I think, about half a dozen Marys. And my mum's siblings between them have 60 children. So there are a lot of repeat names through those 60 children. Funnily enough, there's no other Mary, thank goodness, strangely enough.
Tell me about this man called Pat McAllister.
Oh, Pat. Pat was a wonderful character, worked in our pub. He was a very militant socialist and a really clever, well-read man. And he had gone to Canada as a young fellow and had joined the International Brigade. And with the International Brigade, he sailed to Spain, where he fought against Franco. That didn't endear him, you know, to the Catholic population when he came back to live in Belfast. And he found it hard to get work. But my father, being the kind of man he was, gave Pat a job. So Pat became our barman. And he had diabolical Spanish. He had fluent Spanish, incidentally, but it was absolutely diabolical and delivered in a deadpan Belfast accent for anybody who knew Pat. So Pat made it his task was to teach me bad Spanish and socialism, basically, and the words of the Internationale. I never did get the tune because he was completely tuneless. So he was a big part of our lives growing up. Really, to be honest, as a result of his tutoring, I put in an application. I think I was about 13 to join the Communist Party of Britain and Ireland. My mother nearly had the head staggers, caused awful kerfuffle with the head nun in my school. But thankfully, anyway, that application seems to have died a death. But Pat was fantastic, and he spent every Christmas day with us because he'd nowhere else really to go. He's legendary. He's dead and gone now, God rest him. But he was legendary in Belfast because he was the last of the International Brigade.
And the year you finished school, Mary, your youngest brother was born, Clement. Tell us about how your mum was
treated
and why it bore so heavily on you.
Well, my mum had 11 pregnancies, out of which came nine living children. And between the age of 20 and 38, she had 11 pregnancies. And so that meant that, you know, literally every few months she was pregnant and producing children. But by the time she got to Clement, she was really not. Actually, after the eighth child, my brother Phelim, she was told she really needed a hysterectomy. But unfortunately, she got pregnant again, or fortunately, because of course we got Clement as a result of it, and he's fantastic. But then after Clement, she was really very ill. I was in the middle of my Mach A levels at that time, and my sister Nora was in the middle of her Mach O levels, so the timing wasn't great, to be honest, in our house. My mum came home from hospital with him, and we had to mind him because she literally wasn't fit to put her foot out of the bed, that's the truth, until eventually she got a hysterectomy. Now, her Catholic doctor, who went on for the priesthood subsequently, Dr. O'Raw, he was a lovely man, but he had 11 children, became widowed, went off to become a priest, and never quite made it because he died, unfortunately, before ordination. But he knew she needed the hysterectomy to save her health and her life, actually. So she was sent to a secular doctor, a Protestant doctor in a secular hospital, had the hysterectomy, came home, and the next thing, Father Honorius, he arrived to the house, oh, really so angry. I can still remember him saying to my mother and father, who were both present in the house, that he had heard that she'd had a hysterectomy and that this was unacceptable because she was still of childbearing age. I'd never heard that expression. She was still of childbearing age and his permission had not been sought. And I still remember how my parents shrank that night. They were so, so hurt. So very hurt. And to say that in front of their children, I don't know how many of us heard it, probably just the older ones, because my mother was a stickler for getting the younger ones to bed at 6 o'clock. So I imagine it probably was just the older ones who heard it. But it stayed with me. It stayed with me. It stayed with her too, actually.
It's actually astonishing when I read that, Mary, that it's hard to believe that things like that happened.
Isn't it? And they happened every day, Miriam. That was the control that was exercised by the church. That was the control. And thank God for, you know, for education. Thank God for the liberation that came and the confidence that came from the generations who were educated. Thank God for the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that tells us that we, you know, that we have freedom of religion, of belief, of conscience, of thought, that we have control over our own lives, and that we're able to contradict a church that still regrettably hasn't moved into full acceptance of the reality of those rights, because it still teaches that we are obliged by virtue of our baptismal obligations to be obedient to the church's teaching magisterium, that is the bishops, what they teach. It tells us we are obliged by baptism, you know, to obey. And my answer to that today is no, I'm not. I'm not obliged to obey that. Those baptismal promises and obligations were undertaken allegedly when I was a week old, when I was baptized. You cannot do that. You cannot say to a non-sentient child, you know, at a year or a week or 2 years, that you've now taken on lifelong obligations. And in particular, you can't say it anymore when we have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you know, the European Convention on Human Rights, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, all of which tell us that we have freedom of thought, conscience, and belief. My church has to grow up yet, to mature into that debate. And I, you know, I look forward to being part of that debate. I think it's quite exciting.
I'm conscious also, Mary, you know, that this is a Sunday morning and that there'll be a lot of people listening, almost agreeing with you. And yet, like you, they still love their religion. They still love their church. I'm also aware your wonderful mother is still alive. Do you think people of her generation, Mary, you know, still retain their devotion in a sense to the church, but they choose what they want to believe these days? They choose to behave as they want to behave as good Christians.
Yes, I mean, I still am committed to the church. I still regard myself as part of it and have no plans to leave it, even though at times one could be sorely tempted because the management structure is just so appallingly inefficient at the very best and, well, ineffective. And but yes, you're right. I mean, there are generations of people like my parents, like my mother, and who, for whom their identity and, if you like, their whole social scene revolves around mass and devotions and prayer and the rosary and novenas. And these are very, very important props in their lives. Why? Because it's got them through a lot of ups and downs and a lot of life's very, very stormy seas. And so I would never take that away from them. Why? Because myself, when I, you know, when I hit the buffers, I turned to prayer almost automatically. I still love going into a church. I still love all that. There's nothing I love more than a beautiful sung mass, for example, and beautiful sacred music. I mean, I often think that one of the great attributes that Christ brought into the world was the amazing flowering of music devoted to the Christian tradition and the amazing flowering of art, but particularly of music. I just think it's wonderful. Having said that, I think my mother's generation, now many of them, you know, who had the 9, 10, 11 and children, who devoted their lives to their families, have now grown very sceptical. First of all, feel a deep, deep sense of betrayal by the church when they discover the cover-up by bishops of episcopal, you know, of clerical child sex abuse, which happened in our own family. I mean, the clerical abuse, I won't say sexual abuse, but the clerical abuse that happened, that was covered up by bishops. These were trusted, respected people. Trust was everything. And of course, they've blown that trust. I don't know when it will ever come back. It's certainly, that generation is now, has grown very sceptical, I think, Miriam.
And of course, it wasn't until much later, wasn't it, that your brother felt able to talk about the abuse he suffered in school. Were you shocked? Did you find that very difficult to deal with?
Well, yes, because, I mean, my brother, my youngest brother, Clement, went to, you know, one of the top Northern Ireland most successful Catholic schools. It's in Newry. And the headmaster there was an absolutely appalling sexual predator. And was never stopped in his tracks, even though it seems it was well known by his bishop. Indeed, it was known by the bishop who said his funeral mass, who was a great personal friend of our family. And then, of course, who resigned because he realised that presiding over the funeral mass just was really not acceptable. My brother was 50 before he felt able to tell us about what had happened to him at that school at the hands of Father Finnegan. And to say that, you know, it destroyed our peace of mind would, and certainly had destroyed his for many years unknown to us. I often wondered, he was very, very hostile to the church, very hostile, but at the same time, a person of great deep spirituality, a great metaphysical thinker, a searcher, and, you know, a person who had tried Buddhism and found Buddhism gave him some peace of mind, married to a wonderful Jewish wife. Thank God for her, because she's the person who saw in him that there was something that needed really to be mined and drilled out of him. And with her help, you know, he was able, and the help of good counselling, he was able to tell it. But imagine, my brother's a lawyer. My brother's a trained lawyer. And he's worked in the film industry. You know, he's an expert in health and safety in the film industry. He's a really high achieving man. To think that someone like him could not speak about these things until he got to 50 tells me of the control that these predators had and the protection they had, which is why I think we are entitled to remain for many, many, many decades more sceptical about our senior clerical leaders and their commitment to protection of children.
Well, Mary Lenehan, or MacAleese that she later became, turned 18 in June of 1969. And she had first-hand experience of the violence that erupted in Belfast and across the north that fateful summer.
I was at the Crumlin Road last night when the first petrol bombs were thrown. Protestants came onto the Crumlin Road from Shankill and joined with the RUC in a fierce attack on Hooker Street. Houses were set on fire, as well as a public house and a bookmaker's shop. While firemen were there, the first shots came, reportedly from the crowd. Within a matter of minutes, the shooting was intensified and people ran for cover. With terrible speed, the trouble spread. There were reports that B specials were distributing guns to Protestants in Shankill and that the specials were driving through the streets in tenders and shooting anyone they could see. Throughout the night, sniping became the tactic of the rioters. At 4 this morning, RUC turned us back from the falls area. Snipers, they said, were still at work, and in the distance one heard the ominous burst of machine gun fire. The scene terrified me, but it reminded an American colleague of Harlem. But, he added, it seems easier to get guns here. Dawn over Belfast today showed a grim scene. Buildings scarred by fire, thousands of pounds worth of damage caused, and of course the tragic loss of life.
When did the troops arrive?
The troops didn't arrive till about 7 o'clock at least. 7 or 8, I think it was. And we were left holding the baby all the time. for to feed ourselves, no defence of any kind except stones and what we had, not what we could find in the streets. Next thing that happened was the people on the opposition side, they are supplied with the guns from the B specials.
Were they using guns?
They were using guns. We hadn't a gun at all. And we managed to get four guns unauthorised from our people. And if we hadn't had those guns, the whole place would have been taken over by them.
Did you use these guns?
They did use those guns, yes, but it was more or less to frighten them off.
Were all these houses occupied yesterday?
They were all occupied, yes, yesterday, all by Roman Catholics.
There was endless trouble for your family when you were living in Ardoyne. I mean, 69, obviously, Mary, was a big year in world history. You met Martin yourself that year. Tell me about the 14th of August, 1969. You actually went out to celebrate you getting a place at Queen's to study law. Tell my listeners, what happened that night?
I went out with Father Honorius Kelly, the priest who had told me I could never become a lawyer, but who was now celebrating the fact that I'd got into law school, believe it or not. And so another girl in the parish, a wonderful old friend of mine, Eileen Gilmartin, she had got into UCD, and he was delighted for both of us. And because our parish had 70% unemployment, Miriam, and when girls like us, young women like us, were getting into university, he could see hope for the future. So took us out that night for a meal. We left the parish. I'd never been taken out for a meal before in my life, and this was a wonderful thing. And we came back, and we left the parish quite happily. Now, it was the week of the after the Battle of the Bogside, so things were a bit dodgy, but we never in a million years expected to come back and find her father, the most mild-mannered man that ever left Sligo, standing with a group of men just as where we came into the parish with hurdles in their hand, and we were astounded. And it turned out that the B specials, who you might remember were an auxiliary police force in uniform, had come into our parish that night with a loyalist rabble, and were pointing out the Catholic houses and burning them. So a lot of Catholic houses and businesses were burnt that night. It was a reign of terror. It wouldn't have been the first pogrom against Catholics in Ardoyne. Historically, there was a history of it. Every second generation or so it happened. But this was the first of my experience of it. And it was devastating. I was about to go to law school, and here were the forces of law and order clearly on one side of the community, and it wasn't mine. So that was horrific, because the next day we managed to get home. We didn't get any sleep that night. All during the night, people kept coming to our house telling us what was going on. A wonderful family called the McBriarties. Nurse McBriarty, she brought, I don't know many, she was our district nurse. She brought loads of our family into the world. Her house was burnt down that night while she and her midwife daughter were at makeshift barricades helping a woman to give birth who couldn't get to hospital because of all those shenanigans. So we spent the night, gathering up clothes for the people who'd lost their homes and lost their clothes. And the next morning, I went out down round the parish. One of the first people I met as I walked through the parish was Father Honorius. He hadn't been to bed either. He and all the priests in the monastery had been up all night trying to help people who were just devastated and lost, because of course there was nobody to help them. There was no police force to help them. The police force was the cause of it. There was no protection for Catholics at that time. It was a daunting time. But he wore, I don't know if you know, the Passionists wear these very dramatic, wonderful black woolen cloaks. And he was striding, a very very attractive man with a great sense of drama. He was striding through the parish wearing the cloak and his long soutane. And I met him, and he put out his arms, he stretched out his arms, and he said to me, "We were fiddling while Rome burnt." As I reflect on it, it was kind of an inappropriate allusion, but I kind of figured I knew what he meant. But I still remember walking through the rubble that day, praying to God that all my relatives, of whom there were many, lived in the right in that zone, and thanking God that all my family were safe. But a lot of my friends' houses were not. My best friend lived in the street at that time, one of the worst affected, Hooker Street. She and her family, they were lucky, because their house was furthest away from all the awful, miserable drama. But and so they were untouched physically, but emotionally they were wrecks, absolute wrecks. I mean, I was only in the street. I went up to see could I help them, and I did help them to move out that day. over to a safer, you know, safe zone of kind of a village that was set up almost immediately, a tented village or a village of caravans to help people who needed accommodation. But the devastation that night has never left me. I mean, this was the start of a civil war, Miriam. That's how it starts. You tell me how it ends, because I thought it would last a week. Then I thought it would last a month. Then maybe a year. And then 30 years later, I thought, oh, God, we have to, you know, it has to be brought to an end. And I thought of Dan O'Connell and his memory of, as a young man, being in the being in France, being in Paris during the French Revolution, and seeing there that once that genie of violence is out of the bottle, once it's out of the bottle, no matter how righteous it is, no matter what the cause, once it's out of the bottle, the venom, the contempt, the hate, the murder, the depredation that humanity is capable of is also out of the bottle. You try getting it back in again. Very difficult. It's, of course, what turned Dan O'Connell off the use of violence for the rest of his life. Same here.
And in your memoir, Mary, you speak about your father and the endless attacks. And I know the pub was bombed, your house was attacked. But there's something incredibly moving about the attack on your brother, John.
It's the one that really got to me and provoked probably the greatest anger in me, an anger that, you know, that was righteous but needed eventually to give way to calm. But my brother John is profoundly deaf from birth, and he had been at a deaf club and was getting off the bus on his way home. Actually, the bus stop was directly in line with our house, and he was about to cross the road, a main road, when he was attacked by four young loyalist thugs who broke a bottle over his head and then stabbed him with the jagged edges, including severing an artery, and left him for dead. And we were in the house, my mum and the older children, because the younger ones were all in bed, but we could hear the screams. Because John is deaf, the timbre of his voice when he speaks is very different. I had never heard my brother scream, ever. And we thought it was a bunch of kids from a local youth club acting the maggot. And then I still remember this cold chill that ran through me as I realised, oh, sweet God, it's John, it's John. And we ran to the door. Just at that moment, our doorbell rang, and this poor unfortunate man was standing there, his hands dripping in blood. He could barely speak, and he just brought us out to where John was at the gate of the house. I remember getting into the ambulance with him and praying to God to save him. He survived, thank God, physically survived, emotionally not so, you know, he's had to carry the fear of that and the horror of it all his life. And in particular then the added horror of having recognised him because he was a neighbour. And his father apparently was high up in the Orange Order and supplied we were then told later by one of the very nice police officers who came with John. John drew a wonderful picture of him. John's a very good artist, and in fact, he's an excellent artist, and he drew a great photo fit. So the guy was immediately, we all knew who he was. He's very recognisable. John also pointed him out when he was taken by the police to this young man's workplace. And, you know, 300 guys come through the gate and John pointed right to him. But he was never prosecuted. And years later, a few years later, when I was practicing at the bar in my first year at the bar, by accident, I ran into the police officer who had been investigating the attack on John, a very nice young man. I didn't recognise him. He now had a beard, and he stopped me and he said, I remember you. You were a young law student when I first met you, or you were going to do law. And he said, what an awful pity that we didn't prosecute that young man then. He said, you know why I'm here? He said, because that young man is now up on a charge of murder. He had murdered the Catholic manager of the Ulster Bank, only a mile from our house. And I said to him, as a matter of interest, why didn't you prosecute? Oh, he said, the decision wasn't for me, he said. But, you know, his father, I think, or somebody belonging to him, perhaps not his father, but somebody belonging to him, was very high up in the Orange Order, and they provided him with a cast iron alibi. That was Northern Ireland.
For several years, Mary McAleese worked as a reporter at RTE, beginning on the Frontline programme. Here she is in January 1980, reporting on Irish women seeking abortion services in Liverpool.
Formerly, those who decided on abortion risked their lives with Backstreet Abortionists. Now they simply find their way to legitimate English clinics through friends, sympathetic doctors, or adverts in women's magazines. Liverpool is the most accessible English city, and many Irish women who arrive here look for advice from the British Pregnancy Advisory Service.
Well, the likelihood is that they will find their way to one of the abortion charities, one of the pregnancy advisory services, for help, because these are the main organisations outside the health service which will help women with this problem.
What condition, both mentally and physically, do these women arrive in your experience?
Well, I think a lot depends on the manner in which they came. A lot of women are tragically, a high percentage of women arrive here in quite a distraught state. I mean, you can imagine, I think, the distress that a woman must be in if she contemplates a sudden journey over the Irish Sea, probably a very uncomfortable journey, and not feeling well, perhaps, through the pregnancy itself. Probably coming with very little knowledge of what she's coming to, even if she's actually got a phone number or an address to come to, because many of these women who come have never been to this country before. They really don't know what they're coming to. And, of course, perhaps they feel that the organisation they're coming to may not be a strictly legal one. I think this is often in the minds of these women.
Look, as we speak this morning, I'm here in the studios of the RTÉ newsroom. You came to RTÉ in 79. It's a fascinating section of your book, Mary, about your time in RTÉ. It's an understatement to say you were unhappy here. I mean, when you think back on that now, Mary, do you think it's partly that down the years, a lot of people I know who grew up in the North, in the nationalist tradition, felt that nobody in the South really either cared or understood or respected what you'd been through? Do you think that lay at the root of it in some way?
It didn't help, but I have to say, I came to work with in Frontline in 1979, the then current affairs programme, a predecessor of Primetime way back. And that the year I spent there was a happy year, Miriam. I worked with people I had great respect for. I think they did good, solid work. And of course, our boss at that time, Peter Feeney, had worked in Northern Ireland, had studied there, indeed had studied politics, if I remember rightly, and was very well informed and a very measured man. Yeah. And a very pleasant man to work with.
He's a good guy.
Then that changed. We went to a programme called Today Tonight. I wasn't so happy there, and I wasn't so convinced about its credentials in terms of understanding the North. What always struck me as very strange was, I mean, I was from the North. I was from Belfast. I was from Ardoyne. I'd lived in the place that had suffered most from the Troubles, in terms of, if you were to just judge by the number of deaths, the number of sectarian deaths in it. I had had a lot of experience. Nobody ever asked my opinion, ever. And I had to, during programme meetings, I would offer my opinion, which was routinely jeered at and on the subject of the North. So, yes, I think particularly as we moved into the phase where the hunger strikes particularly started to create a whole new dynamic, a whole new miserable edge to the rawness of Republican nationalist and unionist loyalist politics. It was missed by, there's no point in saying otherwise. I mean, it was missed by the English language current affairs and RTÉ, completely missed. And that's mystifying in its own right, because it was such a seminal time and such a, you know, really important time, and very important that people here would have understood what was, you know, how the tides were changing. But to some extent, I also understood that what was happening in the North was just so appalling that a lot of people just wanted to walk away from it. And, you know, a lot of people in Northern Ireland ran away from it, couldn't get away quick enough, you know, left the country, just got out of there. I mean, I had come to Dublin, it had driven me insane, and still I couldn't let it go. So, yes, and then after that, you know, as you know, I mean, I left Today Tonight because I had completely lost all respect for the programme in relation to Northern Ireland. In other respects, it did good work. You know, outside of Northern Ireland, I would say the programme did really more than competent good work. So I left and went back into academic life, which I've never, ever regretted. But I did stay on in RTÉ, not working in that programme, but working part-time with a programme called Europa, working with Pat Kenny, for example, in radio. And in those two places, you know, I just found, again, great friendships, good people, who restored my faith, really, in RTE and, you know, in the colleagues that I had there. So it was just that one slice. It just so happens that it was an extraordinarily important slice, not for me personally, but for, you know, for Northern Ireland.
And interestingly, Mary, do you think partly that attitude you experienced in Today Tonight, was that what initially people tried to throw at you at the beginning of your run for the presidency? Was that the same kind of undercurrent?
Oh, undoubtedly. You're spot on there, absolutely. Because what always struck me, in fact, one of the reasons why I eventually got around to writing the book was to tell, you know, of my background and to tell what formed me, you know, into really a very formidable opponent of the use of violence, was the realisation that there was a posse of journalists who didn't even bother to find out who I was or what I had done, the role that I had played, for example. Imagine that the Irish Council of Churches and the Catholic Church had asked me to co-chair probably one of the most seminal documents to come out of the Troubles, which was a working document on sectarianism. And can you imagine that they would have asked me to do that unless they were pretty sure of my stand in relation to violence, which would be completely hostile to violence, that had been earned over many years working in the field of ecumenism, you know, working in the field of cross-community relations. You know what? I don't think one single journalist got that. The one exception probably was Tom Kelly in the North, who I wouldn't regard as part of the Southern Posse. But yes, I think that they have questions that they probably have asked themselves. Maybe they haven't ever asked themselves. None of that was presented. It was just, oh, here's this, you know, Northern Provo back to annoy us. Bearing in mind, that's what I had been accused of. I also resented that a great friend of mine and a wonderful journalist, Forbes McFall, had actually been called, excuse my language, an effing Provo in a programme meeting by another fellow journalist, and that had not been challenged initially by anybody except me when I intervened and said, you know, is this the kind of world that we live in, where a person of great integrity can be accused of such a thing? Which was defamatory, and I said that day at that meeting, which is why I never was accused overtly, you know, of supporting terrorism, which I never did in my life. I said, if anybody ever accuses me of that, be sure I will bring you to court. And indeed, when the Independent, the Sunday Independent, came very close to saying that I was sacked by RTE, which I never was, ever, for that very reason, I did sue and sue them successfully. I'll always, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, I'll take so much, and I do have, you know, I think a fair capacity for forgiveness and for tolerance, but there's also a kind of a line in the sand that I can draw and say no this far and no further.
The 1997 presidential election campaign was bruising for Mary McAleese. A leaked memo from within the Department of Foreign Affairs alleged that she was pushing a pro-Sinn Féin agenda. Pursued by journalists, Mary McAleese refused to comment on the leaks.
Mary McAleese arrived in Galway just before 8:30 tonight and was immediately surrounded by a solid wall of supporters and party officials who attempted to prevent journalists getting close enough to her to ask her questions about the leaked documents. She walked through the crowds, refusing to acknowledge or respond to the questions.
Mary McAleese, can we ask you what is your reaction to the Foreign Affairs briefing document that you've been published?
We're doing crap about the door.
Mary McAleese, can you explain why you're behaving like this tonight? Mary McAleese, okay. Jim Fahey from RTE. Can you tell me what is your reaction to the documents which have been published in the newspapers today? Do you accept or reject what's been published in the newspapers today?
For the 5 minutes it took her to get into the hotel, the Fianna Fáil PD candidate continued to ignore questions. The rally organisers restrained journalists on several occasions, and Fianna Fáil's Noel Dempsey claimed we were attempting to assault the presidential candidate.
Mary McAleese, do you have any comment to make on today's published briefing document?
And that was all Mary McAleese was willing to say to us at this time.
And interestingly, in your memoir, I didn't realise you almost did pull out, didn't you, because of that attitude to you in the campaign. I think you were going to pull out the following morning until the narrative changed.
I you've no idea how close I came. I mean, I had made up my mind to, and one of the reasons was that for the 2 years before I ran for election, I was privy to and party to what is known now as the Hume Adams talks, which were so important and so seminal in bringing the IRA into ceasefire and creating the conditions that led to the peace process, and which came out of an idea by a priest called Father Alec Reid. And it was Father Alec who put it together, that if John Hume could speak to Gerry Adams and explain his vision of healing these three-way relationships between the people in the north, between the people north and south, and between the people of Ireland and Britain. And if he could explain that, and Adams could then bring that to the tired men of the IRA and explain that politics was the way forward. It had a number of setbacks, it had a number of successes, but all the time, poor John Hume was being absolutely lacerated on all sides for engaging in talks with Adams. And at one point, because of this laceration from people like the Sunday Press, from members of John's own party, from, of course, unionists, vilification on all sides, I was asked, along with a man called Jim Fitzpatrick, who was chairman of the Irish News, a major newspaper in Northern Ireland, and one of the most decent men that ever God put on the planet, we were asked to try and be the people who would try and go out to these key influencers and explain to them that what was going on was John trying to bring the IRA's campaign to an end, that this was a noble objective and an absolute precursor, a prelude to peace. But these talks, Miriam, were private. They were secret. They had to be, because every time there was a whiff of them, John was lacerated on all sides, and the stress on him was just visible and dreadful. I had never disclosed my involvement in that. Why? Because I was never going to use it as, you know, as a tool to be used in a political campaign. That was absolutely not the case. And I was never going to divulge those meetings and what they were doing. It wasn't my place to do that. And so when I was accused of, at one stage, of meeting with Adams, which was true, I was meeting him. I was also meeting John Hume, of course, and Father Alec. But the story, as it was told, was that I was friendly with Gerry Adams. I never met Gerry Adams at any stage before then, until the context of those talks. And indeed, for a long many years afterwards, when I became president, I only met him in that context. And so I felt I was under pressure, accused, as you know, by a fellow candidate, of being unsuitable to be a president, because the accusation was that I was a fellow traveller with the provost. Nothing could have been so much further from the truth. I could never have revealed the Hume Adams talks. I just couldn't do it. So I thought the best thing is withdraw, to protect that, because that those talks were so central to the peace process. And actually, I had agreed it, and I was quite relieved going to bed that night. I was dead happy. I was thinking, that's grand, withdraw now and all the pressure will be off. And then the next morning, turned on the radio, and there was Father Brenton Callanan, who had asked me to join the peace ministry for the purpose of helping facilitating and helping the Hume Adams talks. He was on the radio telling people why I was meeting Hume and Adams, that I was no provo. In fact, if I had been, of course, they'd never have asked me to join the peace ministry. And I had been involved, of course, in drafting the sectarianism document for the Protestant Catholic churches with very, very senior ministers and lay people from all the other Christian churches who knew my views very, very clearly. And one by one, of course, then they started to come out and say that this allegation was arrant nonsense. I have to say, the man who made the allegation knew that very well himself. That was Derek Nally, because he and I had worked together when he set up the victim support organisation. He had asked me to help him, and I did. Now, he'd never have asked me to help him in a million years if he'd thought that I had any truck with paramilitarism of any sort. He's a good man, and a decent man. And but it was the heat of a campaign, an electoral campaign. Awful things get done. Actually, poor old Eddie Roach during that campaign, for whom I've the greatest respect. Eddie, she took some abuse as well.
Yeah.
Also, Miriam, it was personally quite hurtful. And of course, then I stayed in the campaign. But you have to understand that what was going on back home was that because of those allegations, my children and my father-in-law, who was minding them at home, were now at risk from being targeted by loyalists. Like, it wouldn't be the first time we've been targeted by loyalists. And we lived quite close to a very strong loyalist hinterland. But thankfully, at that time, the police force in Northern Ireland, which was then the RUC, before it became the PSNI, they were very helpful at that time.
One of the standout moments of Mary McAleese's two terms as president was this speech by a fellow head of state.
Argus Akoiza. Prince Philip and I are delighted to be here and to experience at first hand Ireland's world-famous hospitality. Together, we have much to celebrate. The ties between our people, the shared values, and the economic, business, and cultural links that make us so much more than just neighbours, that make us firm friends and equal partners. Madam President, speaking here in Dublin Castle, it is impossible to ignore the weight of history, as it was yesterday when you and I laid wreaths at the Garden of Remembrance. Indeed, so much of this visit reminds us of the complexity of our history, its many layers and traditions, but also the importance of forbearance and conciliation, of being able to bow to the past, but not be bound by it.
Your presidency had lots of highlights, but I suppose for most people, and maybe for yourself, it was the visit of Queen Elizabeth. Now, I gather, reading your book, it was your idea that she might say a few words in Irish, Mary.
I wrote them out in the back of an envelope phonetically, but not for her. I mean, the story really was, I had suggested, that, among a number of things, that if she used a few Irish words, that it would go a long way, that the respect of doing that, because we were only going to get one speech from her, remember, during the 4 days. And so the speech was very important historically. And of course, one of part of our history is the absolute damage that was done to the Irish language quite deliberately by the British administration in the 19th century in Ireland that hurt still, about which there was righteous resentment. So one of the things I suggested was that she might consider saying a few words in Irish, not very many, just a few. But there was pushback on that idea, and I understood why, Miriam. To be honest, it was, you know, it was sensible. Mm. What I was told by our side, and the same advice had been given to her, I think, on her side, was, look, there's such, you know, neuralgia around the Irish language that if, for example, she even said a few words and if she got one word wrong or stumbled, you know, it could be seen as giving offence and could be misinterpreted and wouldn't be a good start. So I understood that perfectly. It was very risky. And so my view was, having discussed it back and forth, look, let it go. We'll not bother pushing it. But when her deputy private secretary came to see me, I did say, you know, to him, look, I'm not talking about her making a full speech in Irish here. It's only 5 words, and I think that they could be really historic. But he then explained to me all the reasons why it was a dangerous thing to be doing. And I said, you know what, forget about it. I'm going to take it off the agenda. I understand perfectly, and I understand that it's actually out of respect for the language that this is the answer. That was fine. Then sometime later, a friend of mine who had been the British ambassador to the Holy See and was then the High Commissioner in Islamabad came by our house came by the Arras, actually, on his way back. His dad lives in Northern Ireland, so he called in to see us. And he said to me, you mentioned to the deputy private secretary, who was his mate, his friend, 5 words. What were they? And I said, I'm not going to tell you because I don't want this subject raised again. Leave it. He said, no, it's not for the Queen. It's not for Her Majesty. It's just for, he said, that my friend was sorry he didn't ask you what they were. He just wants them for his own record. And he took out from his pocket a scrappy old envelope And I wrote the words out phonetically, and I said, you know, these are not for Her Majesty the Queen now. We understand that. I had, between them all, they played me very well, I have to say, because on the night when she got up to speak those words, even though earlier in the day, one of the people who worked with me, Maura Grant, came into me all excited, having been over to Farm Lee back and forth, you know, making the final arrangements, saying, oh, they're all joking about the Queen practising her Irish. And I said, what? And then she said, no, that's only a joke. And then the back of my mind, I'm thinking, is there something going on here that I'm not sure about? Anyway, it turned out, of course, that she said those five words that I had written out phonetically. That envelope is currently in Perth, just outside of Perth, in Fremantle, where the said former ambassador is now working as vice chancellor in a university. And he keeps reminding me that it's one of his prized possessions. It never made its way to the man that it was intended for, may I say.
Mary, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to me this morning.
Oh, not at all. It's an absolute pleasure to talk to you, Miriam. It always is. Thank you so much.
On Drogheda, the Bridge, performed by Liam O'Flynn and Mark Knopfler, and composed by Liam for the inauguration of Mary as president in 1998. And that's it for today's show, which was produced by Tom Donnelly,